welcome back to another episode of the Hall of Jostis Comic Cast. As always, you've got Above Average Joe here and...
Mighty Mike.
Mike, what accent were you going for there?
The one that's not this one.
Okay. Yeah, so we're back, and kind of a somber episode today, of course. About a month or so ago, we lost a legend in Steve Ditko. He passed away at 90 years old, so we thought it was appropriate to do a World Builder episode on him.
It's made us kind of wary, because when we do World Builder episodes, either someone has died, or they die recently after we do the World Builders episode. So, we're feeling a little cursed around here.
It's like the death note of podcasts.
It is.
Yeah. So let's go ahead and just dive into the life and history of Steve Ditko.
Yeah, Joe, take it away.
Okay, we're going to get into kind of his secret origin, if you will. He was born on November 2nd, 1927 in Johnstown, Pennsylvania. He was the second eldest child in a working class family, very humble origins.
Yeah, it was a small mining town in Pennsylvania, so very, very rural.
And the cool thing is his father was a master carpenter, but really inspired his love of comics because he himself loved the news strip comics.
Oh, he loved
the dailies. In particular, Hal Foster's Prince Valiant, which is one of the most classic dailies out there. You have his passion for comics and the art and the form instilled at such a young age. And that really accelerated once we got into the age of superheroes.
Just craftsmanship in general.
With Batman, and then later on kind of continuing the next evolution of both superheroes and the Mystery Men or the Minutemen aspect was Will Eisner's The Spirit. So those are two of his big influences.
Jeremy Robinson, particularly.
Jerry Robinson
for the Batman, the artistry.
So in junior high, here's a kind of a cool thing. We keep doing world builders on people who were surprisingly badass going into World War II.
Yeah.
But at first, in junior high, in the kind of the buildup to World War II, he was part of a group of students that actually crafted wooden models of German airplanes so they could aid civilian spotter.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I'm like, I didn't even know that was a thing. I went down the rabbit hole researching this and was like, that kind of kick
ass.
That's
kind of cool,
yeah. And then, of course, after graduation in 1945, he enlisted, went to the U.S. Army. He served in Germany kind of post-war.
Post-war, yeah.
And that set up and actually really started drawing comic then as part of one of the Army newsletters. Yeah. Of course, following his discharge, he studied under his idol, Jerry Robinson, at the Cartoonist and Illustration School. In New York City, which is now a school of visual arts.
Which was also a huge impact for him, moving from a small mining town in Pennsylvania to New York. And New York was the background of the drop of most of the comics he wrote.
Doctor
Strange and Spider-Man for New York, definitely.
I mean, even just from a publication standpoint, I mean, DC got out of New York, what, 2-3 years ago? But still, just the idea that he was studying under his mentor. I mean, under his idol. I mean, that's a huge thing. I mean, to
grow up reading this guy and be like, I love this guy's art, and then go and study underneath him.
I mean, I get, you know, goosebumps meeting creators that I've loved my entire life at comic book conventions. I can only imagine how much he was freaking out learning from him.
It's so funny, because Joe has, like, all the celebrity goosebumps, and I have, like, no celebrity height whatsoever. Like, we were meeting
Chewbacca. You're completely
Chewbacca,
placid.
And I was talking to Chewbacca, and I ended up talking to his wife for, like, 20 minutes. Just like, hey, how's it going? Yeah, okay, cool.
Meanwhile, I'm freaking out about the tall guy who wears a rug for a living. Yeah.
Yep.
But kind of a fun fact here, Robertson, he actually brought in Stan Lee when he was the editor of Atlas Comics, and that's kind of the first real meeting between these two.
Yeah, Robertson was very impassioned of like the school to job pipeline. They really wanted to hook his students up and get them into the business.
And actually, Robinson found Ditko commented on his work, but he found him to be a very hard worker who really focused on his drawing. And someone who could work well with others as well as write his own stories and create his own characters. So it shows that Ditko wasn't just the pencil man.
Yeah.
He was the vision. He was visionary. I mean, he could write, he could draw, he could create universes as well, which is something we see a lot of in these early world builders that we talked about, is people who can cross the lines between writer and artist and really help bring a vision into reality. So he started at that school, and actually Robinson was so impressed with his output that he helped him get a scholarship for the next year, because you have to stay in the school, you have to continue to hone your craft, you're too good of a talent
drawing,
to just go
drawing, just keep drawing, here we go.
Oh Lord. Musical interludes from Mike. So he began, I think, professionally drawing comics, because of course, you know, everything he did in the army and stuff. But I believe it was in 53, early to mid-50s, when he was really first getting started. And I know it was a romance comic. It was like a 6-page short in Paper Romance. Or I think it was Daring Love Number One. The story was called Paper Romance. Well, it's kind of interesting. We even talk about this in the Jack Kirby word builders, that the big medium at the time before, like, the advent of more superheroes, the Marvel age.
Comics, it was romance, westerns, detective novels, noir, like, it was completely different comedies. There was no superhero comics.
Well, I mean, even with the advent of most of the DC characters who were around longer, they were still very minority players in the comic book world.
Very much so.
And it wasn't really until the Marvel age that really shifted. So it's interesting that there's a lot of parallels between the creators.
Yeah, there were so many more penny dreadfuls, as you would say, of like small horror stories, and like before there were superheroes.
Oh man, I mean, Atlas Comics was a big proponent of the horror stuff. You had
Tales to Astonish, Tales of Suspense,
Tales from Dracula's Tomb, which is where Blade showed up, I think. So not after he really started that initial, you know, publications with Paper Romance. He started to work at the studio of Joe Simon and Jack Kirby.
Mm-hmm.
So he started as an inker, and he was primarily doing backgrounds and building work, really the grunt work of art.
Yes.
Because you talk to any artist, and pretty much all of them will tell you that we hate drawing backgrounds.
It's like, yeah, it's doing your dues.
So he got to work under them on that studio, and he also got to work with Golden Age artist Mort Meskin, who is really, I mean, he's a pillar of character of creators, especially for the Golden Age. We're probably going to be doing a world builder on him at some point. He's a big player, and it's during this time that he began to move over and started to work with Charlton Comics. And Charlton Comics is going to come to play a lot in some of the characters he created, because everyone knows, you know, his Marvel creations, but he did a lot with the Charlton universe and DC that we'll get into later on.
Yes.
So he begins working with them, and I think his first actual cover was for the Thing number 12, and then he also did like an 8-page vampire story, like a backup story. So again, you can start seeing the horror elements there, which would really come to help him with a certain doctor that he helps create. And then 1954, he actually went on a hiatus because he contracted TB.
The consumption.
That's pneumonia. So he contracted
tuberculosis.
He contracted TB and went back home to Johnstown to recuperate. And then, of course, after he recuperated, he goes back into the city. But let's go ahead and talk about really the characters he helped create, because those are, of course, the big pieces that we want to discuss here. Now, I think, Mike, correct me if I'm wrong, but there's a rather, I guess you could say he's a popular character.
I don't know.
I think he's got some personal issues, probably has a whole thing about responsibility.
He doesn't care for it.
Yeah. Okay, we're screwing around. Yes, Steve Ditko was the co-creator of
The Amazing Ant-Man. It's Spider-Man.
I really wish you guys could feel the look. I just shot Michael from across the table. Yes, he co-created Spider-Man with Stan Lee. Of course, Stan Lee originally had Jack Kirby draw the art for Spider-Man.
It looked a little too much like Captain America. It was much more adult, bulky.
Yeah.
And so he refined what the criteria was for the character, and then went and talked to Steve Ditko and was like, I want more of this. Will you draw this for me? And Steve Ditko nailed it.
And he gave us the classic imagery that we now know as Spider-Man. In fact, even as far as influences go, the eyes. There's a very, very telltale Ditko eye style to Spider-Man, which they brought into the suit design for the MCU.
And particularly the full face cover, because that wasn't done at the time. Everybody wore cowls or just eye masks. And it
was the age of domino masks.
Yeah, exactly. And it was specifically done as a design choice to hide his boyish youth, because if he was going with the cowl like the Jack Kirby design, everybody would know, is like, that's the chin of a boy, that's not the chin of a man, and the small features and everything. So that was specifically done to hide his youth and inexperience. A very great choice that it's remained it the iconic Spider-Man from now and forever.
Yeah, exactly. He really helped define the look and feel of the character.
Yeah, Stanley.
And not just the character, but the universe, the way that Steve Ditko drew Spider-Man in action.
Oh, very much. He had a very fluid motion and
almost inhuman in ways, which is very odd given...
We'll get to, like, his design choice. It's like
we'll get to his style.
He does a really interesting thing. It's very cinematic in his thing. For the longest time, he did a nine-panel page was one of his techniques, where it almost felt very cramped and...
And for those of you who don't know, the nine-panel grid is kind of the bane of most comic book artists.
Yes, it's very cramped and confined and kind of like paranoid almost in the way he drew Peter all cramped. Like it added so much more tension to it.
And I was going to say that. Yeah,
he always
managed to capture the feeling that Peter was cramped.
Yeah.
And that actually really helped kind of lend tension to the story, because let's be honest, the storytelling in the very first few issues of Spider-Man is very hurried until you get up to like issue 3.
And the time he put in as a background artist really paid off, because New York for him in the Amazing Spider-Man, in Steve Ditko's Amazing Spider-Man, New York is a character.
Background is a character.
Like at the time, like him, unlike anybody else, pretty much him and Kirby did just so much characterization in the background, which hadn't been really done before.
Yeah, most backgrounds were typically either washed out in color or very simple. Both, and really Ditko really used expansive backgrounds, and he did it a lot with the next character he helped invent, which was Doctor Strange.
Mm-hmm. And this one was a wholly created entity by Steve Ditko.
Yeah.
And Marvel's titled back and forth, but there's a publication, an anthology of all of an omnibus, if you will, of Steve Ditko's work, and they have it in publication saying, hey, Steve came up with this 5-issue short. We don't know what it's going to do or run, but we'll run it. And I believe it's in Tales of Suspense.
It was in Strange Tales. Yeah, he took the name of the book.
Just Doctor Strange. We don't know what it is, but it was Steve's idea, I believe is the way it was phrased. So they've given him credit in publication as it being wholly his idea and wholly his creation, which is really, really weird, because the man was whole, and we'll get into it later, the man was wholly a conservative entity, and the idea that so many hippies and people who were taking drugs were loving his book and using it as like holding it up on a shrine of like, oh, this is far out, man, and everything, like he must be on drugs. So like, no, he just had it. He wouldn't ever touch this up.
Well, that's the thing.
Very
like, he
creative,
was...
abnormal mind and creativity.
And what's interesting is that he was such. I mean, he was a big proponent of objectivism.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we'll get into his Ayn Randian.
Well, yeah, we'll get into that strange stuff. But he was so far away from the medium in that regard, mm-hmm. that he was able to approach everything with this kind of, no, this is just what it looks like aspect. I mean, if you go back and look at some of the early issues of Doctor Strange, they're completely
psychedelic.
Zany.
I wouldn't put it anything less
than
that.
That's something that the movie actually captured really well, mm-hmm. is just how banana balls Doctor Strange's world is.
I'm not joking when I say that when this came out, hippies in mass loved it, and people... with literally, there's documentaries and stuff filmed about Steve Ditko and things about Doctor Strange, that people would drop acid and then go read Doctor Strange, and they're like, there's acid tests, and they're like, okay, so let's see if you're on acid, read Doctor Strange, are you feeling anything? Like, what's going on?
All I can think is like Crimson Bands of Sidorak right now.
Yeah, Crimson Bands of Sidorak.
I just think we should have Doctor Strange in a black.
By the Hoary Host.
Oh God. Anyway, Powers of the Vishanti, moving on.
Mm-hmm.
So those are, of course, his big Marvel creations, and everyone is definitely aware of Spider-Man. And everyone knew of his involvement with Doctor Strange, but you do now.
Mm-hmm.
But I mentioned Charlton Comics earlier, because Charlton was actually absorbed by DC, and he was able to create several characters for Charlton Comics and play off the existing medium for DC. Charlton Comics had a character by the name of Blue Beetle, who was very much just kind of your Indiana Jones-esque explorer. He had this scarab that gave him powers. And
he did the second iteration.
He did the second iteration, Ted Kord, my personal favorite half of Blue and Gold.
Mm-hmm.
I love Ted Kord as Blue Beetle, because he's very much... just the one guy you wouldn't expect to be a superhero.
Yeah,
I mean, he's slightly overweight. He's nerdy. He's kind of dumpy. He's, you know, just a great character. He created the Question, who is by far one of my favorite obscure characters. And these are things that don't really fit your standard superhero niche, but they fall into the overall landscape of the DC universe really well. Yeah. He also created the Creeper, who is...
His superpower is he laughs all the time.
And he's
like, as
just,
far as I can, from research and looking into his comics and his issues, like, that's...
He dresses
flamboyantly.
He's acrobatic. He laughs. He's kind of like the love child of Joker and a hyena.
Yeah.
Which is probably...
I'd say, like, Joker and Wild Thing, or Wild Child.
Buona Beast.
Yeah.
So, yeah, the Creeper, who's always been a character who showed up in more zany titles like The Brave and the Bold and... a lot of random things. Actually, books usually featured Buona Beast, now that I think about it.
Mm-hmm.
But both Blue Beetle and The Question were both important to the DC Universe overall and actually helped inspire another book, which really drew a lot of influence from Ditko, was The Watchmen.
Mm-hmm. Alan Moore drew specifically...
Well, Alan Moore wrote it. It was... God, I can't remember the gentleman who did the art. Dave Gibbons.
Yes.
They really did a lot of stuff Ditko style. The 9-panel grid.
And we've talked about... The one thing I'll talk about later is another character he created, especially in the controversies, is Mr. A. And,
oh, yeah.
In The Watchmen, the influence and inspiration for Rorschach was drawn from Steve Ditko's The Question and Mr. A, a combination of those two characters.
Yeah, he was
influenced by that.
He had Mr. A's temperament and characterization, mm-hmm. but he was very much a question
and
prestige.
Absolutism.
Yeah, and Night Owl was pretty much Blue Beetle in a different costume. Like, it's just straight up, like, it's bing, it's Blue Beetle. So that those are really good homages, and it kind of shows his lasting impact. But let's go ahead and talk about Mr. A, Mike.
Yeah, this is one of the last character we'll talk about that he helped create. Actually, let's before we get in all to Mr. A and go into his controversies, let's talk about one more for DC, Hawk and Dove.
Oh yes.
So Hawk and Dove this will also parallel greatly into controversies. Hawk and Dove was right around the Vietnam War, and the writer behind Hawk and Dove wanted to show the two parallels, kind of two sides of the coin, War and Peace, of two ways of approaching to the war that was a reflection of what was going on in the country. And that's what the characters are supposed to be. And Steve Ditko was like, no, and he's great, deeply, deeply conservative. So he drew Hawk as like authoritarian and strong and go-getting. And he drew Dove as weak and effeminate and powerless and like and very feminine for a man, and they
which is
kept...
odd considering Dove ended up becoming a woman in later iterations.
And they kept, so the writer and him kept, and he only stayed on it for I believe like 8 something issues.
Yeah, I think
but
it was 8 to 10 issues max.
He helped design the characters, but they just kept clashing. He's like, that's the writer was like, that's not my character. I'm telling you that you're letting your politics influence your art way more than you should be. And they ended up, and part of his objectivism, where it's absolute thing. It's very much absolutism. And he's like, if I can't have the absolute interpretation of my art, it's not worth doing. And he walked away from that.
I would also like to point out that Hank Hall, who is Hawk, ended up becoming a villain.
Yeah. There's also some little small tidbits of uncredited things that he gets for. It was actually his idea for Hulk to be changed when he becomes angry. A little small thing.
Yeah, because it used to just be as soon as the sun went down.
Yeah, and that was a cool little influence that made a great impact on the story.
Because that changed in, what, like the first 10 issues, I think?
Yeah.
It was relatively early in his life. Sorry, go ahead.
So, after having conflict with Stan Lee with Spider-Man and leaving Marvel primarily over a difference, from what I've been able to establish, he's a very reclusive man. He does not do interviews. Once he left comics, He does not go to
any... married.
Yeah, never married. Never went to any conventions. There's only about 3 to 5 existing pictures of him. He hated to have
one
his
of which he
taken.
Drew.
Yeah, it's so there was a lot of political friction between him and Stan Lee, especially in Spider-Man. He would draw Peter Parker running through a crowd of protesters. They were like protesting against war and whatnot, and he would expect Peter to be like, damn hippies, you need to get rid of them, and then Stan Lee would author into the bubble instead of that. Alright guys, keep up the protest, I'm with you. And so they were just incongruous to work together.
Oh yeah.
And then same thing happened on Hawk and Dove. So he wanted to go, he went independent, and he came up with a character called Mr. A. Because right around this time he got really into Ayn Rand, and this goes into the kind of the controversy of Steve Ditko in the bringing up the auspice of judging an artist by their art and not by their person and their politics.
It's definitely necessary here.
Speaks for themselves. So, Mr. A completely balks the Joseph Campbell hierarchy of what a hero should be, and the hero's journey and everything like that for all modern heroes, and it sets up as him as an Ayn Randian objectivism hero, and he professed this many times. That's a contradiction
in terms, but okay.
Yeah, he professed this many times, because after he became a devout follower of her philosophy, that there is, he would tell this to people before he came up with that. Mr. A, he would take a note card and draw half black and then leave the other half white, and it's like, there is no good, there is no gray, there is only black and white, there is only good and evil, there is nothing in between. So Mr. A was a character who was an objectivism character, which means there's no, you don't do something for the greater good, you do only things that benefit yourself. So he would let people die, and he would say there was no, you were either good or you were evil. If you'd done anything bad in your life, you were evil. And he would, the stories became very repetitive. He would find a villain, pretty much do battle with him, punching. He was, his daily life was a porter that was looking for the objective truth of things. And he would give his card to the villain. It would turn white or black if they're good or evil. And they would obviously get themselves into usually some kind of situation that they was of their own making, but they had regrets and they wanted to get out of it, and he would not help them, and he would let them die. Pretty famous issue is there is a woman who is a social worker who's like, it doesn't work in objectivism. You're only supposed to look out for yourself, not for others, so social workers don't make any sense. And a young boy that she'd been trying to reform and look after stabbed her, and then she gets chased down by Mr. A and gets knocked off the top of a roof and holds onto a flagpole, and the woman is like, save him, save him, and he's like, if I save him, you could bleed out, even though it's just a stab wound to, she wouldn't butt out, but anyways, it doesn't matter, because he lets the kid fall and die to his death, and then after he picks her up and carries her away, he's like, even if you weren't stabbed, I wouldn't have rescued him. I would have let him die. So he was a very, very weird superhero, but he definitely fit the objectivism mold of the Ayn Randian philosophy that you should only, there is no greater good, there is no sacrificing yourself for the good of others. You only do what benefits you. And
suddenly makes Dr. Manhattan seem warm and fuzzy.
Yes, absolutely. And you can kind of see why he left Spider-Man, because
Spider-Man's Parker, a very inherently sympathetic character.
Yes, and Peter Parker had his he came up with his webbing and everything, and he used it to help other people instead of profiting off of it himself and making it.
I mean, just the cornerstone of his, like, the first half of his first issue is rebuking the idea of profiting off of his own heroism.
Absolutely, and that is very much the antithesis to Ayn Randian objectivism. You're supposed to look out for yourself only. And that's kind of like the antithesis of all superheroes. It's always for the greater good and saving other people and at great self-sacrifice.
At the detriment of yourself, yeah.
Absolutely. And he was a person who would not be afraid to walk away. And there was claims that he would have stacks and stacks of checks in his office, of checks from Marvel that were uncashed. And all the way till his death, he lived a very modest life.
I think he lived in the same apartment for years. I think the only next of kin he had at the time of his passing was a nephew.
Yeah, because that was the moral thing to do for him. If you could not seek and establish the absolute execution of your art the way you, like, you got to give it to the man. He stood by his values.
Oh, yeah.
If you could not exceed the execution of your art, then it wasn't worth it, and just walk away. There's no point if you can't have it absolutely the thing that you want to do. And that's one of the reasons he left Marvel as well, from the political standpoint, but also the argument, him and Stan Lee didn't talk for 50, 60 years, something like that, because he wanted to say that he was the co-creator of Spider-Man, and Stan Lee said, I have no problem saying, I consider, and he wrote a signed, like, letter and everything and sent it to him, that I consider you to be the co-creator of Spider-Man, and That wasn't even enough with him, because he didn't like the word considered. He was very absolutist. It gets weird because...
Oh, you know, it got tense between the two of them, especially from a legal standpoint. It probably was right up there with the claim between DC and the Siegel family about Superman.
Yeah, because I fall... Actually, when you listen to... There's very few recorded interviews with Steve Ditko.
There's like five grand total.
And when you listen to them, and then you listen to recorded interviews with Stan Lee talking about it, I tend to fall more on Stan Lee's side. Because Stan Lee, his argument is, I came up with the idea. I'm the creator. Steve Ditko was such an objectionist absolutist that he said that the idea is not the creation. It's the person who brings it into reality, and I drew it, so therefore I brought it to reality, so I'm the creator of it. And yeah, I'm like, no.
It's very much kind of...
He said an idea is not reality, but drawing is. It's
the flip side of the Bob Kane and Bill Finger argument, where
yeah.
Batman was created by Bob Kane, if you're thinking along the way of of Steve Ditko, but everything you know about Batman and love about Batman, just from the visual design to the character history, came from Bill Finger.
Yeah.
And for years he wasn't credited, so it's interesting that they have that kind of shared dynamic.
So the way Stan Lee puts it, it's like, I'm the guy who came up with the idea of Spider-Man, and I thought it up, and I said there should be a Spider-Man, and first of all, he took Spider-Man, like we said, to Jack Kirby, and he came up with came up with a character design, but he was too much like Captain America, so he went to another artist, and he's like, he had more critiques and criteria there for he was able to get a better design character that more fit what Stan had imagined in his mind. And that was Steve Ditko's Spider-Man.
Although, interestingly enough, Stan did use the cover drawn by Jack Kirby.
Yes. What's interesting to me is I like to put it this way, because I tend to agree with Stan. And Stan is the creator, the originator, the point of origin of it. Of the conceptualization of Spider-Man, and Steve Ditko was the designer. So I still believe that Stan Lee is the creator. He came up with the idea for Spider-Man, Steve Ditko helped design it.
If they were strictly literary mm-hmm. characters, I would totally agree. I think it gets muddled when it comes to comic books because the visuals are such a mm-hmm. integral part of the character themselves. So I still see them as co-creators, but I mean, from an objective standpoint, yeah, Spider-Man is Stan Lee's creation.
Yes.
He was the progenitor of that particular idea, that concept, the core of that character.
Yeah.
Spider-Man, as we know him, is the byproduct of Stan Lee's vision and Steve Ditko's art. So I have no problem claiming he's a co-creator. I would have every problem with Steve Ditko saying, no, he's my creation, and I'm like, no.
Yeah, that's what he was drawing too much emphasis on creator for something that I was comfortable with.
I would agree with that.
For pulling way too much along with that. And I was like, no, he's not. You're putting too much emphasis on that. If there was a percentage, it would be 60-40. It's not 50-50.
Well, again, that's a byproduct of his viewpoint, saying
yes,
that this thing was
absolutism.
This was not a concrete fixture until I put ink to paper.
Mm-hmm.
Therefore, it is mine because I'm the one who brought it into quote unquote reality.
And it's weird because he was like so angry and upset with Stan Lee over it, but Stan Lee throughout his life insisted that he get credit for it. Like,
well, not just that, but I think like the first time he got film credit for Spider-Man was actually in Civil War. Because up until then, it was the original
Spider-Man movies. You go back and watch them.
Spider-Man created by Stan Lee. I never saw Steve Ditko there.
Yeah, it does say. It says because Stan Lee made sure
that Steve Ditko got
credit. And it says in the original, oh my gosh, the guy who directed Evil Dead.
Sam Raimi.
In the Sam Raimi movies, it says Spider-Man created by Stan Lee and Steve Ditko. And Stan Lee made sure that he got hat credits. The impact of him.
Yeah.
It is beyond the controversy, beyond his questionable politics. The impact that he made is undeniable on the comic industry. He influenced heavily people like Alan Moore, Neil Gaiman.
Dave Gibbons, obviously.
Dave Gibbons.
I think Steve Ditko had a very long-standing impact. I almost think...
Spider-Man 33, the final chapter.
Oh,
that
God.
One is one of the most iconic moments
if this be my destiny
book history. Steve Ditko, in three full pages of Spider-Man lifting machinery off him in that final, like, moment of hurrah in Excelsior, where he lifts it up off himself and it succeeds. That was Steve Ditko, and that is iconic beyond all belief, and it inspired so many young comic artists forever to this day. Even in the latest Spider-Man Homecoming movie, with the scene that was inspired by that, because it is one of the most iconic moments in all of comic book history.
So yeah, I think there's a lot of lasting impact from Ditko. I honestly think his bigger impact is not so much in the characters he created, but in the way he helped, because of this conflict with Stan Lee, helped define the roles of creator and owner. Because that informed a lot of discussions, a lot of partnerships going forward, because previously a lot of comic book creations were simply under work-for-hire contracts. You were paid to draw this, you don't own it, I'm paying you because I need someone to draw this particular thing. He's probably one of the more prominent versions of separating art from artist, because reading about his final days and his final years is kind of depressing, because he's this creative titan. Regardless of what you think of him politically, he's a creative titan. I mean, he gave rise to so many important things, and
it's very wasted interesting away too, because it's not something he was unaware of. He's been quoted by saying that he didn't want to do interviews or anything like that for over like 3-4 decades. He would not, because he goes, I don't want you to know me. My art should stand for itself, and my art should speak for itself, independent of who I am.
Yeah.
And that's all should be all you need to know. And unfortunately, in this time and age, it's not like the Renaissance, and you can look at a picture and painting weird. And understand you a person who they are has an impact on how you appreciate their art. You can't look at it in a vacuum.
I kind of respect his choice in that regard.
Oh, he has great moral foundations, but a value structure of sticking with it. Like, you could not say the man was a hypocrite, or he did not have his principles, or he would refuse to compromise.
No, he stuck by his convictions.
100%.
In his sentiment of wanting to be defined by his art, not by his life, I can kind of respect that. I think it's a byproduct of his generation.
With the exception of Mr. A, which was heavily, heavily politicized and heavily...
Yeah, I think that was his, you know, old man on a soapbox
moment.
It
really was. Some of them, like, weren't even stories. It was just,
get off my lawn.
It was straight-up propaganda.
Yeah, and to his credit, that's fine. Again, I feel like... Because comics were really a big shift in creative and literary consumption, where fans wanted to get to know the people that they had, you know, become attached to.
Yeah.
I mean, look at our particular reactions whenever we meet creators. I get, you know, googly-eyed, and you're just like, oh, what? So that's what he looks like?
Yeah, what's up?
So that's pretty much the life and times of Steve Ditko. It feels kind of like a bummer to end the episode on this, because he really did just kind of pass.
The man gave us Doctor Strange, and he gave us the iconic Peter Parker Spider-Man and the design that resonates throughout the generations to today.
But again, we are doing our listener requests, so don't forget to reach out to us on Twitter at Hall of Jostis. Let us know what characters you want us to cover.
Really dig deep. Let's get weird.
Get into
who
the obscure
stuff. Who
are
you curious about, man?
Ted Kord.
We'll break
Say
it
Ted
down.
Say
we'll
Ted
break
Kord.
It down.
But make sure you tweet at us at Hall of Jostis using the hashtag listener request, so we can make sure we file everyone's responses, because we're going to be doing that later this season.
Just pepperoni from Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles. I'll do a whole episode about pepperoni.
Oh, God. Please, no. I would rather talk about Venus de Milo than pepperoni. Please, please.
The Rat King.
Anyway, also don't forget, you can get a hold of us not only on Twitter, but also at Facebook at Hall of Jostis, and we have a Facebook group dedicated to fans of the podcast.
It's called Jostis League.
The Jostis League. Get in there, talk to other fans, even help decide the fate of the show, because we do a lot of polls and a lot of conversation in there.
Absolutely. And guys, don't forget to check us out on iTunes and drop us a review if you can. It really helps us to understand and get some good feedback, and it also helps up us in the charts for people listening, and really helps get our name out there. But again,
we want to make sure you guys don't think we suck.
That's right. That's true. We got to hear. We really appreciate all of our listeners out there. We love you guys and gals. And that's it for us. Thanks for listening.